You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the World News Roundup with updates on Russia and Ukraine, a ban on some short-distance air travel in France, and more. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, chances are, if you've been looking for affordable housing in Wisconsin lately, you haven't had as many options as you might like. The state needs more than 100,000 additional housing units to catch up with current demand and to meet the needs of the next decade. That's according to a report from Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. The groups behind a new package of bills in the state legislature hope they can address at least some of the supply side of the housing issue. State Senator Romaine Quinn is a Republican representing Senate District 25 in northern Wisconsin. It includes Rice Lake, Spooner, Park Falls, and Phillips. He's a co-sponsor of this package of four bills. I talked to him yesterday afternoon. Well, I think a lot of people have encountered the problem of high-cost housing. We've talked about a lot on the show. Can you tell us what you're seeing as the scope of the problem we're trying to solve here?
Well, frankly, we're in a housing crisis right now, and it doesn't matter what income level you are or where you live in the state. There is a critical shortage and a critical need into every corner. So it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing. It's this big of a problem, but it's a good thing because it finally has the attention of the entire legislature, because no one is immune from the shortage of housing today.
Before we get into the particulars of the bills you're looking at, let's talk about the process a little bit and who you've had at the table. That's an interesting part of the story, I think.
Yeah, everybody. So I just want to give a shout out to Representative Rob Brooks. He really initially spearheaded this, and he brought everyone to the table. So the Builders Association, the Realtors Association, the League of Municipality, Towns Association, counties, anyone that would have a stake or an impact in the development of housing. And so I'm pretty excited because we have had everyone at the table. I think we're really almost 99% there, just have a few technical tweaks left. But these bills are ready to roll.
All right, let's dig into some of the particulars in the bills here. Let's start with this idea of right zoning or truth in zoning aimed at helping local governments get projects approved and off the ground.
So developers need certainty. That's a huge component of this. They have to know that when they find a plot of land in a particular area that's zoned a particular way, when they develop a project, they have to know it's going to be approved in a timely manner, because our construction season is very short in northern Wisconsin. And if it's not here, they'll build somewhere else. So what we want to do is say, hey, communities, go back and look through your ordinances, through your master plans, through your zoning requirements. And is this really where you want to be, or could there be more flexibility? Because once these are set, you have to approve projects that fit your criteria. So communities would no longer be allowed to move the ball on developers when a project is trying to come in. We've seen this in a few communities where some neighbors come and complain to their council members or planning commission, and pretty soon the project keeps changing and keeps getting whittled down. And instead of 90 units, it's 60 units. And all of a sudden, it's cost prohibitive. It just doesn't pencil out. So we just want to say, whatever rules you have, you choose. The state's not telling you, but then you have to actually follow them and approve projects in a timely manner that fit them.
Now, I could see maybe somebody listening saying, hey, wait a minute, that was me. I lived in a neighborhood. I saw a development that I think would have negatively affected traffic or what have you. And they might worry, is this taking away my ability to go to my representatives and have a say in what goes on in my neighborhood?
Nope, you absolutely can still do that. But what you would want to do is talk to your council member or your representatives to say, hey, what is our master plan today? Where does my house fit in that? And do I like what's on the books? So it's really going to require them to go through and do a final review process to say, hey, knowing that we have to actually approve projects based on our current regulations, what are our current regulations? And are they what we want to see today and tomorrow? And we'll fix those. So this bill does give them time. It's a year before implementation, and that's why even the League of Municipalities is neutral on the bill. They're not opposing it because we're not necessarily telling you what to do. We're just saying, hey, get your house in order and follow your own rules once they're established.
Another bill aims to provide loans for a Main Street housing rehabilitation, in some cases using those second and third floors, I think, of a downtown building. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I don't think there is a Main Street anywhere in any little community in Wisconsin that does not have spaces that are unused above their downtown businesses. So we want to incentivize and help developers or those business owners to say, hey, look up. And those apartment spaces that are used for storage or were just abandoned, can we refurbish those and create some downtown housing, which again, fixes our housing problem, but also helps to revitalize those businesses in downtown areas that we're always struggling to do. So it's a win-win there, I think, for people looking for housing and for the businesses in our downtown areas.
Now, if I'm a developer, I could say, okay, I can go on the outskirts of town and do, whatever, 20, 30 units, or I can do what, one or two units at a time? How are you hoping the structure of these loans will incentivize a developer to pay attention to that kind of project?
Yeah, and that's part of the problem is they're never going to come into a downtown and do that unless they have the cheap or free capital. So these are 0% loans that would go towards these projects. And so it helps to sweeten the pot and the bottom line just a little bit, where maybe they would take a second look.
Talking to State Senator Romaine Quinn about a series of bills aimed at tackling the high cost of housing in communities around the state. Another bill on the list, Senator, is what people have called the Shopko bill. Now, my Shopko I used to go to, I understand, is being used as a, rental storage facility. This bill is aimed at getting vacant commercial properties converted. It's a tall order, in some cases easier said than done, into residential. What does this one do?
Exactly what you just said. We want to take some of these abandoned, blighted, or underutilized properties that probably have a pretty good location based upon the existing business or what business was there, and reconvert those into housing. So we would, again, give you a 0% loan to either demolish, take those down, and build back into residential housing, or if you can actually refurbish them and make them fit for housing opportunities. We want to help developers do that as well.
And then finally, there is another loan program. Now, I've had friends buy an older building, and wow, it's a good thing they know what they're doing. It's a tall order, takes a lot of work and renovation. Another piece of legislation targets some of those older residential buildings. What does this one do?
Yeah, as we are looking at expanding housing opportunities, we got to stop the bleed. We got to stop losing the housing stock we already have today. So if I can help you with a zero interest loan to put that roof on, to put that siding on, or change those windows out and keep your property from deteriorating to the point of no return, let's do that. And then there's, again, 0%, you have the ability to pay that back over time or with the sale of your home, trying to make sure that we're keeping the stock we already have. Wisconsin historically has quite a bit older housing stock compared to other states, and especially in my district, like the city of Superior, has some of the oldest housing stock in the entire state. So we just want to make sure as we're expanding opportunities, we got to be able to keep what we have as well.
Now, a lot of these involve loans, 0% loans, which sounds pretty good given that interest rates have gone up lately. Can you talk about that approach of a loan as opposed to, say, tax credits or direct investment or other fiscal options?
Well, I think it's hard when we start talking about grants, right? What businesses, who are they? Because this is taxpayer dollars, and we have to be fiscally responsible with that. So by having a 0% loan, we're giving you the capital you need to get these projects off the ground, but it will come back to us in a revolving loan fund, and that's the best part. So let's say I'm a community and I need $1 million or $2 million to retrofit an old Shopko building downtown. Well, when I pay that back, that goes back into the pool, and it's going to fund the next project in the next community with someone doing the same thing. So we have a lot of one-time money in this budget. I can't think of anything better than setting some aside in a revolving fund that will continue to make gains on the issue of housing that we have.
As we wrap up, Senator Quinn, what's the timeline on this package of legislation?
Well, I had a hearing on them all in my committee last week. We are working on some real technical minor changes. There's a few amendments being jockeyed around, but we're very, very close. So I'm hoping to exec these out of the Senate committee by next week.
Senator Quinn, thanks again for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was State Senator Romaine Quinn, Republican representing Senate District 25 in northern Wisconsin. I talked to him yesterday about a package of affordable housing bills he's co-sponsoring in the legislature. Coming up, we're going to hear some responses to these bills from the president of the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What does the supply of affordable housing look like where you live in Wisconsin? Do you work in one place and have to live fairly far away because that's the closest you can afford? Is the market you want to buy a house or rent an apartment in Wisconsin or beyond affordable for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about a new set of legislative proposals to address the shortage of affordable housing in Wisconsin. Russell Caney is with us now, president and co-founder of the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing. Russell, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for the invite.
Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about your organization and what it does?
Sure. The Wisconsin Council for Affordable Rural Housing was established in 1997 by a group of developers and property managers and others that really saw a need for education, advocacy, and collaboration with other funders across the state of Wisconsin in affordable housing, but with a real emphasis on the rural parts of the state.
I think sometimes when people think of affordable housing problems, they might think in a, you know, a growing city, an urban environment. Can you talk about some of the challenges in rural and smaller town Wisconsin?
Sure. Across Wisconsin, as we know, there's some real economic drivers in the state, Madison, Milwaukee, kind of the triangle down to Beloit, and really growth areas. But when we get to a lot of the smaller communities, particularly the ones that we hear from and where we have a number of people that are in our organization, they have different circumstances. They may have an opportunity to recruit a business, recruit teachers, others to their community, but the housing many times is a barrier to get people into those communities. Not only just the inventory of housing that might be available, both rental and home ownership, but then just what the cost is for that particular housing. So we see that all over the state.
Senator Quinn used the word crisis there. Do you think that's overstating it, or is there a crisis, at least in some communities?
No, I think crisis is a good word. There's nothing like a crisis. I think what he's done, and I applaud him for his efforts, what he's done is elevate the conversation so that it's including all parts of the state. And I particularly like his position from the standpoint of speaking from northern Wisconsin, where a lot of housing issues have just not been addressed.
Let's get your thoughts on a couple of the proposals we heard from the senator. First, the bill to revitalize main streets in Wisconsin with incentives for developers to work on those units, as we heard, above those downtown storefronts.
Yeah, that is a program that I think would work very well under the right legislation and put together the right way. Wisconsin has always had a very supportive and strong Main Street program, which was developed by the National Trust. And that has worked with a number of communities in the past. There are, and what you do see in Wisconsin is you have a lot of federal funds for housing that come down to the state and then are distributed to different developments, developers through Wisconsin agencies that basically administer those funds. I applaud all these bills, really, because they're really generating activity in the state of Wisconsin and not depending so much on the federal government and those federal funds flowing down. Now, with any of these bills, I think it's important to realize that the more that you can leverage with federal funds that are already coming into the state of Wisconsin, the better off everyone will be, because you'll be able to create more housing. The Main Street program, I can go through many of the downtown communities and look up, as he was mentioning, and seeing a lot of vacant space that could be put to good use, particularly in housing.
And another bill incentivizing rehabilitation renovation of single-family homes. How big a deal is that in rural communities?
Well, it is, because we have old housing stock in Wisconsin, and particularly when you go to some of the rural communities, you'll see homes that were many times built in the after World War II, many before that. Many of them need upgrades, energy upgrades, windows, doors, you name it. Sometimes these things are taken care of when the home is sold and someone moves in and does a rehab of the home. But many times these are longtime homeowners that need help and just those upgrades and keeping those homes in good condition for the next potential owner down the road.
Talking to Russell Caney with the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing, looking at a lack of affordable housing availability in many communities around the state. Some new proposals in the state legislature aimed at tackling at least parts of that problem. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, so I'm very interested in this topic, and I commend the intention behind these bills. I'm confused by the way Senator Quinn described the bill pertaining to homeowners getting a loan to rehab. He gave the example of a roof on an old house, for instance. He was talking about those homeowners being able to get a zero interest rate loan in the same way that these bills provide for developers. But in the copy of that bill that I was able to get, it actually explicitly changes the law to prohibit homeowners from receiving a zero interest rate loan from WIDA, and instead takes away that ability and requires that there be an interest rate charged to homeowners, while simultaneously requiring that these loans be offered at a zero interest rate to developers. I suppose it's possible that the text of the bill that I was able to get from the LRB, you know, has been changed while this is in negotiations. But that's something I really hope that Senator Quinn could clear up, because the text of the bill I've been able to find contradicts what he just told you.
John, thanks for the call. Russell, this is a moving target. Do you know how that is shaken out so far, that specific detail on 0% interest loans for that homeowner during renovations we were talking about?
Yeah, I do not. But I would say that, you know, there's need for both. I think from current homeowners that need to do the repairs and do the rehab and just don't have the funding, that would be helpful. I can also see where there's a lot of abandoned homes or homes that have gone through foreclosure that may be picked up by a developer or a builder. And to incentivize them to come in and do a good rehab, not just patch things together and then just rent it out in a condition that's really not appropriate for good living space. I can see where that would be a good incentive for developers, builders, particularly ones that are emphasizing or are really into the rehab business.
John, thanks for calling in and pointing that out. Russell, you were just out visiting, I understand, some apartment renovation projects yesterday in Grant County. Can you tell us some of what you saw and how it fits into our conversation?
Yeah, our organization has a developer and a management company that took on and bought from a nonprofit a 39-unit development that was originally built back in the 1970s for seniors. This was in Cuba City, Wisconsin, a small community of 2,100 people. And there's no other dedicated senior housing in that particular community. So this property was, frankly, just tired. It needed a lot of work, a lot of rehab. It was still occupied, people still living there. But along with some ARPA funds and some affordable housing program funds from the Federal Home Loan Bank, tax credits from WIDA, patching together other bits and pieces of funding, there was a complete rehab of the 39 units. So they had a reopening yesterday with community folks there, gave a tour of some of the units. So it was really nice to see a property that has been rehabbed and will be in good shape now going into 2024 and beyond for seniors in that community.
That's interesting, Russell, because I think a lot of times about this housing issue as, you know, workforce housing, workers being able to afford to live in or near the place they work. Can you talk about seniors and how communities are dealing with that for people who want to retire and stay in the community they've lived in and age in place as much as they can in the community they've been living in?
You know, aging in place is important. If they can stay in their home, particularly as they get older and start having some physical disabilities and such, there's all kinds of rehab that can be done to older homes to attempt to keep folks and seniors in their homes, whether it be ramps or doing some modifications to the bathrooms and such. The other important part is just to have some other alternatives available in that particular community, whether it be assisted living, whether it be apartments that are appropriate for seniors, again, with maybe no step type one floor access to units. A lot of the seniors want to stay in their communities as they get older. They don't want to have to make a choice of moving away to get good housing and then leave their friends, their churches, their communities behind. So it's important that we have a senior population that's large in Wisconsin and really is a backbone of a lot of these communities.
Russell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Russell Caney, president and co-founder of the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing. He joined us for a look at efforts to build more affordable housing units around the state with four new bills on the issue in the state legislature. Just a little while ago, we heard from State Senator Romaine Quinn, co-sponsor of that legislation, talking about what it would do, the impact it might have. Now, we want to hear from you. You can share your story if you've been on a quest to find housing, rental or buying something. Tell us about it. Did it go easily? Were you able to find something you could afford? Are you still looking? Are you having to get something that's really technically out of your price range to live where you want or need to live? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or is there a piece of this story you want to hear more about? It's something we could tackle in a future conversation or pass along to our news team. Again, email ideas@WPR.org with your experiences or your questions. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, for a lot of people, we have our calendar age and a mental age where we might think of ourselves as, in many cases, younger than we actually are. Find out why our self-image doesn't always match the number of candles on that birthday cake. And the author of the new book, The Power of Language, tells us why learning a second or third language can have huge benefits at any age, not just in terms of, you know, being able to talk to more people, but benefits for our brains, our mental and emotional well-being, too. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, childhood trauma can have long-lasting impacts, but there are roads to recovery and resilience. We'll look to the world of primate research for some lessons and then turn toward work being done here in Wisconsin to overcome the impact of adverse childhood experiences. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to expand our flavor horizons and learn about some new ways to mix and match ingredients with the author of The Flavor Thesaurus. First, we humans can be strongly affected by traumatic experiences that happen early in life. And we're not alone. Other mammals, including baboons and hyenas, have shown long-term effects of early trauma. In humans and some other primates, adverse childhood experiences are associated with a lot of health problems in adulthood and even, in some cases, an earlier death. But gorillas seem to be an exception. New long-term research has found that gorillas, which are one of humans' closest living relatives, don't seem to suffer so much from long-term negative outcomes of childhood trauma. In fact, male gorillas that have experienced three or more adverse experiences early in life tend to live longer. We're looking at this new research on gorillas, why they may hold clues to how trauma works in humans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest about this research, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin Morrison is an affiliate scientist at the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and a senior researcher at the University of Zurich, where she studies gorilla behavior and evolutionary biology. Robin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Can you talk at first about the scope of this research? This is long-term, a large population of gorillas. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yes. So this is the population of gorillas that has been monitored since the late 60s. So they were first started being studied by Diane Fossey 55 years ago. And so we're very lucky to then be able to use all of this data that's been collected over the last 55 years about these individual gorillas' lives to understand how what happens to them early on then affects them later on in their lives.
And talk a little bit about the sorts of early events you were looking for, and then, as you say, tracing later in the gorillas' lives.
Yes, so we wanted to look at things that were kind of good parallels for things that can happen in humans and also things that have been studied in other species as well, so other animals. For gorillas, bad things that can really happen to them are things like losing their mother. That's a big one because, you know, she's their most important social contact. She's kind of there fighting their corner in every interaction they go through. So maternal loss is a big one. Also paternal loss. So fathers do a lot if you're a gorilla. They're very caring, and they provide a lot of protection as well. So losing a father can be really bad. Also things like group instability. So if your group breaks apart, if you have a sibling that's very close in age with you that perhaps you have to compete with a lot, or one of the big things in gorillas is actually quite violent interactions between these groups. So some young gorillas experience quite extreme violence at a very early age, perhaps losing one of their siblings through kind of a violent attack from another gorilla. So all of these sorts of things can happen to young gorillas. So they do have a lot of potentially very traumatic events going on in their early lives.
When we look at these gorillas who had these traumatic events early in life, what did you learn about their outcomes, about how they developed later in life?
So we were really quite shocked when we looked at kind of the long-term survival outcomes of these individuals, especially the ones that suffered from a lot of early life trauma. What we found that was that unlike all kind of other species where this has been looked at in detail, in the gorillas, they seemed to be doing quite well. And actually, those that experienced the most traumatic events in early life were somehow surviving the longest. So this was really polar opposite to what we were seeing in other species.
Why? Do we have a sense of why that might be? Why gorillas would be so different?
I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question. So we've got some ideas, but we don't yet know. And really, we're looking at kind of what is different about these gorillas compared to other animals, compared to humans. What's going on that could help them overcome this early life adversity? And there are two things that really stick out to us. One is that in this habitat, these gorillas are living off, they're kind of feeding on all of this vegetation that's all around them. So we like to say that they eat salad and they're living in a salad bowl. Basically everything around them they can eat. And these foods are available year round. There's very little variation and there's not a lot of competition for getting them. So they have access to these kind of readily available foods all year round. So there's very little variation in that. So that's one theory we have. The second theory is all about their kind of social groups. So we know they live in these really supportive, really cohesive social groups. And one thing we've examined is if a young gorilla loses their mother, who's their most important kind of social relationship, what we see is that all the other gorillas in the group really strengthen their bond with that individual, especially the dominant male. And so rather than kind of becoming a social outcast, they become really central in their group and they have a lot of social support from other individuals. So our theories are that it's this availability of food, this reliable availability of food, and also these really kind of cohesive, supportive social groups. So it could be both, it could be either, and we really want to dig into what could be going on.
Talking to Robin Morrison, affiliate scientist at the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and senior research at the University of Zurich, looking at research on early trauma for gorillas and what it might mean for other species. And Robin, obviously part of the research is to understand gorillas themselves. You said at the beginning also we're comparing and contrasting with other species, including humans. What kind of either lessons or questions does your research raise for you about other primate species?
I think when we look at what's going on in baboons, so baboons have this crazy, crazy opposite reaction. So in baboons, we see individuals that are experiencing a lot of adversity and surviving half as long. And when we compare that with gorillas, we see the opposite going on. So one thing that's really different between these two species is where they live. So their habitat is very different. So that is potentially one clue as to what's going on there when we compare with other primates. I think really the possible lesson from this research for kind of humans and maybe other primates too, is that it might be kind of not just providing resources, but also making sure we're providing social support, and that potentially these two things in combination are really important for helping individuals through early life adversity and kind of buffering them to these long-term effects. But we don't know this yet for sure. And so this is really what we're going to be digging into next to really understand how we can take this and kind of learn what important things there are to learn that apply to potentially humans too.
Now, one interesting difference in humans, and we'll be talking about this with our next guest in a bit, childhood trauma is often linked to risky health behaviors, smoking or heavy drinking. Well, I don't imagine that's an issue for gorillas, for example. But what kind of what do you think this tells us maybe about how trauma might affect gorillas and humans differently?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea. I mean, humans obviously have all of these kind of risky health behaviors, things like gambling and smoking, like you said, and gorillas really don't have a parallel, but perhaps there are other behaviors that are risky if you're a gorilla. So maybe kind of your willingness to start fights with other gorilla groups, or perhaps you're gambling on, you know, whether you're going to be able to entice some females from another group into your group. There are kind of aspects of that kind of potentially risky behavior that could be a parallel in gorillas, and something that we should look into in the future to see whether that sort of thing is going on in gorillas. And it's maybe possible that they could, that could actually have benefits in gorillas in ways that it doesn't necessarily in humans.
To what extent do we see big personality differences among a group of gorillas?
I think personality really is a big part of the variety of behaviors. When you see enough gorillas in the wild, you really get to know, you know, some of them are quite shy, some of them are quite timid, some of them are very, very family oriented. And there is a really wide variety of kind of personalities going on in these male gorillas, and also in the females too, and kind of what their preferences are. I think personality does have a big part of kind of the variation in behavior that we see day to day working with these gorillas.
And Robin, as we wrap up, what is your next step, your next big question when it comes to the impact of early trauma for adult gorillas?
So the next things we really want to do are look into kind of how early life trauma influences their social behavior across their lives, whether they're kind of interacting differently with other individuals because of this early life trauma. And then we also want to tie this to kind of what's going on hormonally for them. Are there differences hormonally for the gorillas that had a lot of early life trauma? Are they potentially responding differently to things like stresses in their environment? And could that offer clues as to potentially how gorillas are so resilient to early life adversity whilst other species aren't necessarily?
Robin, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Robin Morrison, affiliate scientist of the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and senior researcher at the University of Zurich, where she studies gorilla behavior and evolutionary biology. She talked to us about her research, finding that gorillas appear to be more resilient to early life trauma than many other primates and other mammals. Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher tells us what we know about the impact of adverse childhood experiences here in the state and what we can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how adverse childhood experiences affect people later in life? Have you experienced problems yourself in adulthood because of this? Do you work with kids? What kind of things do you see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about how traumatic experiences early in life can carry negative repercussions years later in adulthood. Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, include things like physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, neglect, living with someone with substance abuse disorder, and having an incarcerated parent. A higher number of adverse childhood experiences is correlated with negative health outcomes, sometimes even earlier death. But our next guest says with the right treatments and interventions, it doesn't have to be that way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your life story? What do you want to know about how trauma can affect our brains and bodies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and clinical associate professor of human development and family studies at the UW School of Human Ecology. Dr. Nafzaria, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here again.
As you listened to Robin Morrison's research, in this case on gorillas, did anything ring a bell or sound familiar with the work you've done on adverse childhood experiences in us humans?
Yes, gosh, there was so much there, and I think it just highlights how much we can all gain from studying other species, including other primates, to learn more about us humans as well. I think the thing that stuck out to me was this hypothesis that perhaps gorillas that had a higher ACE score, that had more of these adverse experiences, were actually developing better social connections, because we see this very clearly in humans, that one of the strongest protective factors that children have against adversity is what we call relational health, the strength of their relationships with others, and that has a deeply protective effect. So if that hypothesis comes to be shown to be likely true, I think it underscores what we're seeing in so many humans.
I listed some of the different examples of adverse childhood experiences. What kind of problems do those early experiences bring about? What kind of problems are they correlated with later in life?
It's well known that there are a lot of issues that do happen when humans have higher numbers of adverse experiences as children, and how it appears in each person can be very different and very variable depending on them as individuals as well as external factors around them. So it can lead to problems with behavior, mental health, which is obviously tied in with behavior, physical health. Even we see higher rates of chronic disease like heart disease and so on when there's higher ACE scores. And so forth. But I think what's important to recognize is that so many of these things can be mitigated through what we're now calling PCEs, positive childhood experiences. So we can mitigate these effects in childhood by providing ample, safe, stable, supportive, and nurturing relationships. And even if they happened, the adversity happened, there is treatment that can be done later on, but we need to look for it. We need to identify it, and we need to make sure that adequate treatment is available with a good evidence base for it.
I've seen you give presentations on adverse childhood experiences, and that's, I think, one of the main things I took away is that, you're not doomed to these outcomes of adverse childhood experiences. How are we doing, though, at getting these kind of detections and interventions in place to help those kids overcome those adverse childhood experiences?
It continues to be a challenge. I think as a society, we are very much not all that interested in prevention. We are more interested in trying to treat issues afterwards, which is much more costly and takes a lot more resources. So I think that that's pretty consistent for a lot of things, and it's true with adversity as well. We need to recognize that we all end up paying for it, both literally in terms of dollars as well as the emotional and other lost talent costs to society when we don't get it right. But I do think there's something to trying to balance out the notion of adversity, which I think, we've been talking about so much in the last decade in particular, to also then say, but we should also be focusing on a strengths-based approach. What is there, and how do we protect and promote that and recognize how powerful those positive experiences are in trying to balance out the adversity, the effects of adversity.
Talking to Wisconsin doctor Dipesh Nafzaria about adverse childhood experiences and positive experience for kids, how they balance out, how they affect kids down the road, even into adulthood. Dr. Nafzaria, what do we know about how these ACEs, these adverse childhood experiences, can affect a kid's brain and nervous system?
The brain of a young child is so fascinating because human beings are born relatively helpless. Our brains are not fully formed. And the reason for that is that if you allow that brain to reach the same level of development that it does in other mammals, the head would be too big, right? You wouldn't be able to be born, and that would not be compatible with the species surviving. So the compromise, so to speak, is to have a relatively helpless baby being born, and then spending certainly the first year and well beyond through the first 5 years of life, where that brain is finishing up a lot of that quote unquote basic wiring that needs to happen. And this represents both an opportunity and a threat. The opportunity is that if we give good, supportive, nurturing environments, that brain wires for language, for learning, for love, and for literacy. And if we don't provide great environments, that brain wires for threats, for scarcity, for safety, for things like that. So the choice is ours as a society. What inputs are we going to provide for those young children?
Now, maybe this is a fine point. I might use adverse childhood experience and the word trauma interchangeably, and I think I'm wrong when I do that, Dr. Nafsaria. Trauma is kind of what follows the event, and we can kind of shape that in some ways. Could you talk about that distinction?
I don't know if this is necessarily a distinction. I think it depends on how people are discussing it. I would say that trauma is adversity, and adversity is trauma. I think the after effects, the post-traumatic situation is certainly different, and that can look different in different individuals over time.
Part of your work, Dr. Nafsaria, is to bring these things to the attention of doctors and other healthcare providers around the state to be aware of these adverse childhood experiences. What kind of things are you doing? What kind of things are you encouraging healthcare providers to do?
Mm-hmm. What we're really talking about now is assessing early relational health. Again, what's the health of relationships with that family? Because we know that if every child has a deep, deep need to have at least one, we hope more than one, but at least one safe, stable, supportive, nurturing relationship in their life. So how do we assess that? How do we assess the health of children and families and how they interact with each other and how they support one another? And if we can, and we can do that within just a few minutes as part of regular checkups, and we can either support and protect and promote what they're already doing right, or we can help kind of offer guidance where we maybe see some places where it could use and benefit from some improvement, or to do that repair work if things have already started to go downhill. Because trauma does that. It frays those relationships. So if we can actually offer routes to be able to do all those things, the prevention work as well as the repair work where necessary, we're going to see big payoffs.
Are there things we can do to help the people raising children, parents or other guardians to take care of kids to help prevent these adverse childhood experiences and to have these strong positive connections?
I think the number one thing is that when we work with children and families is, I'm going to throw in a quote from Ted Lasso here, right? Be curious, not judgmental. Be curious about what they're saying about their child. When they make an observation that you find puzzling, right? Like, oh, my child is mean. Really? What? Tell me more about that. What makes you say that, right? Because maybe it's something we can help them reinterpret or get a new vision or new perspective on in different ways. And then being supportive about how difficult parenting is. Parenting is a challenging task, and acknowledging that and then saying that you believe in their ability to do it, right? A lot of it is bolstering the confidence of parents. I think all parents don't feel confident at some point about the job they're doing as a parent. I know I don't. And my kids are in college and they would still probably tell you that I get it wrong sometimes. So if we can do that sort of work to help support parents in that role, I think we'll see very big payoffs there in terms of reducing all these things.
It's a good place to leave it, Dr. Nafsaria. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and Clinical Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW School of Human Ecology. He talked to us about the lifelong impact of adverse childhood experiences and ways to counter that impact. Earlier, we heard from researcher Robin Morrison with the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund looking at her research on early trauma and why gorillas look different from a lot of species with how they respond to that in the long run. Coming up after the news, our guest shares new and sometimes surprising flavor combinations, things like sesame and chocolate or cumin and yogurt. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we want to hear from you your favorite combination of two or more flavors. Maybe something that you found surprising the first time you had it or used it. Let us know right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.